among the progressive zeitgeist, the dominant view has been a discriminating, dividing view. We constantly talk about what differentiates us from the others among the progressives. I think we exhaust each other a lot. We're going to be exhausted by, you know, fascism very soon.
Welcome to The World Unspun. I'm your host, Maxine Betteridge-Mose, and I'm here with New Internationalist contributing editor Jamie Kelsey Fry. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, lovely to see you, Maxine.
So this week's guest on the show is the brilliant Turkish journalist and writer Ece Temelkuran. You actually introduced me to her writing not that long ago, and I'm really glad you did because she's really helped me wrap my head around what the hell is going on, especially with the re-election of Trump in the US. Can you tell me a bit more about how you found her writing and why you recommended her as one of the first guests on our podcast?
So the reason I became very, very interested in Ece is twofold. First of all, here we have someone who is talking about what's happening in the world. She saw it originally through the lens of what's happened in Turkey and the rise of Erdogan. And it's a process that is the natural end point of neoliberalism, which is tyranny, the rise of fascism, the extreme far right. And she captured it so brilliantly in this book called How to Lose a Country. And I became extremely enamored by that and then read together. So people asked her to respond to this. What do we do about the rise of fascism? How do we meet it and head it off at the pass? And together is an immense celebration of the human spirit. And she writes like she's an exquisite writer. So what she has to say, her message is fundamentally bloody marvelous. But the way she expresses it is I call her the Arundhati Roy of Turkey, which, you know, is such a facetious thing to say. But anyone who reads Arundhati Roy, good God, the way she writes is so exquisite. And it's the same with Ece. And as a result, being, you know, contributing to Ece for New Internationalists and being dedicated to sort of anti-colonialism and anti-neoliberalism for most of my life, she became a hero straight away. And it's always dangerous to meet your heroes. But in this case, Ece is an absolute bloody diamond at the same time as being an incredibly important writer in the 21st century.
Okay, amazing. Well, we normally release this show every 2 weeks, but in light of recent events, we're bringing you the episode a little bit early. So let's get right into it. Thanks so much for listening to the show. Thanks, Jamie, for helping introduce this amazing guest, and we hope you enjoy the episode. Hi, Ece. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm really excited to speak to you today.
Hi, Maxine. It's a pleasure.
So we have a lot to get through. There's so much I want to talk to you about. But before we kind of get into your book and your writing, just to start off, I'm kind of curious to know what it's like for you living in Berlin right now, especially with everything that's going on in Gaza. What's it kind of like for you to be there right now?
Living in Berlin at the moment is like living in Turkey 2010. I mean, like, I see almost the same things happening in Berlin, which is not a good sign, obviously. It was then in Turkey that we started to experience this almost hard to notice process. And it was disappearance of words. Certain words became too dangerous to talk about. Certain words became stigmatized in a way. So this is what's happening in Germany on a different scale for different reasons. Then in 2010 in Turkey, criticizing AKP was the stigmatized attitude, let's say. If you did that, you were automatically considered to be against democracy. And now in Germany, if you use the word genocide, or if you even use the word Gaza, you're not stigmatized necessarily, but there is a certain sense of fear. Whenever I give a speech or whenever I even have a casual conversation with people, whenever I use the word Gaza, the fabric of silence changes. It's like, you know, it's not normal silence. It becomes lead heavy. And then everybody sort of holds their breath. And, you know, that change in the silence, I think that is when the process of authoritarian regimes or fascism in that sense begins. It is the embryonic form of what is to come.
And you said it's like living in Turkey in 2010. Can you talk, for those that don't know you and don't know about your story, can you talk about why you're no longer in Turkey?
Well, it's a story that starts in 2012. Nowadays, the play adapted from my novel, Women Who Blow on Knots, is playing in London. And I wrote that novel in 2011 and 2012 in Tunisia. And the reason I was there was because there was a massive prosecution against the journalists. So I was one of those journalists who was in demand, so to speak, by the regime. So I felt I didn't feel secure to go back to country, so I stayed in Tunisia, wrote this novel just to do something. And then, you know, I was fired from my job due to two articles I wrote against Erdogan. And the only thing I could do was to create some characters, some female characters, to hold me when everything was falling. It started then. And then Gezi Uprising happened in 2013. Again, death threats, rape threats against the women like me, like, you know, who were speaking up. And then time passed. And then 2016, there was the coup attempt, you know, against Erdogan. And then Erdogan, being a political genius, used this crisis and turned it into a biggest opportunity for himself. He suppressed the country even more and so on. And at that time, I think the atmosphere of fear, the constant sense of threat, paralyzed me. And I thought, I can no longer write, think, or do anything in Turkey. So I left. I left for Croatia and I lived in Zagreb for 6 years. Bottom line, it was the fear that it was forced upon us that made me leave. It is interesting because fear, I mean, like, you can resist against it, but then at some point your life becomes resisting against the fear and you can do nothing else, nothing intellectually deep, nothing artistically meaningful. So I think in order to realize myself, I had to leave the country to be able to function as a human being and as also as a writer.
I've got the book with me here. I actually have the old version, though. I've got How to Lose a Country, The Seven Steps from Democracy to Dictatorship. And you are re-releasing the book under a new title, which is The Seven Steps from Democracy to Fascism. And I think before we really get into the discussion of the book, I feel like it's really important to kind of lay the groundwork of what you actually mean and what we mean when we say the word fascism. So can you maybe just start by just giving us a pretty simple definition of what exactly is it when we talk about fascism?
First of all, I'm so happy that it is popular now to use the word fascism, because when I published the book, it was a, you know, hush-hush word. I had to have serious debate, serious conversations with my editors all around the world, especially with German editors, actually, to use the word fascism. And after big debates, I kind of pulled back and I stepped back and we used the word dictatorship in the subtitle. Now the horrible popularity of the use of word fascism comes too late. And now it feels like, to many people, actually, it still feels like, and no, it's not fascism. This is authoritarianism and so on. I think that attitude, shall we say, attitude of, you know, not being sterile when it comes to using the word fascism is a historical mistake and also an ideological mistake. Because the rejection of the word fascism for such a long time was due to two reasons. We all wanted to believe, or we were made to believe, rather, that fascism was buried in the battlegrounds of Second World War. Fascism was beaten by liberal democracy, forces of freedom, and so on. Nazis, bad guys, the others, good guys, and so on. And we were taught this history of good guys prevailed over bad guys, so we can no longer have the danger of fascism. But it is also an ideological proposition. It tells us, when there is liberal democracy coupled with neoliberal, you know, economic system, a free market economy, there is no possibility that the system can produce fascist inclinations. And this ideological proposition was also used for anti-communist, anti-socialist politics as well. So my use of fascism is due to two reasons. Historically, no, it wasn't buried in the battlegrounds of Second World War. It lingered. You know, the regimes, the world order that was built after Second World War was actually recruiting the elite of Nazi Germany in science, in arts, in politics, everywhere, in industry. And also fascism is not a German brand. It was present in every country. So they were present after Second World War. Fascism and fascist, you know, ideology was very present after Second World War. This is one reason. And the second reason is ideologically, yes, I do think that neoliberalism feeds fascism. Fascism is embedded in neoliberalism. You know, when there is a little bit social justice, when there is a little bit economic prosperity, you cannot see it. But when that prosperity is coming to pieces, like it's happening today, you can see the fascist, you know, the hidden fascist face of the system. The use of the word by the establishment is very successfully hiding the fact that fascism is embedded in neoliberal system or in liberal democracy when it's coupled with unleashed neoliberal policies.
So when someone says to you, or when you hear it in the media, like, oh no, that's not fascism, that's authoritarianism, what to you is the differentiation? Like, how can we spot the difference?
The bones of fascism is about capital being in, you know, in coordination with the state apparatus, oppressing or controlling the masses, the working class. So this is what's happening right now already. So we don't need to see like military boots or like funny mustaches when we talk about fascism. If working class, if intellectual class is oppressed to the limit that they cannot even ask for their rights, to the limit that they are helpless in terms of changing their precarity, then there is already fascism.
And I think the way you put it of fascism feeds neoliberalism is a really interesting way of looking at it. And we know that like the neoliberal revolution came about after or sort of during the 1930s in the midst of World War II. And it's arguably the most successful, at least in terms of its global reach. So can you sort of talk then about what you think the counter-revolution to this is? How do we push back against this sort of fascism and neoliberalism feeding into each other in this massively successful global revolution?
Neoliberalism is such a successful ideology that it made us forget that it is an ideology. It made us start thinking that it is the natural order of things. It wasn't subtle because after Second World War, in 1950s, especially in 1960s and 70s, there was a resistance against neoliberalism in Europe and in other parts of the world. It's especially my part of the world, which means not only Turkey, but MENA region, like Middle East and North Africa, in, you know, Asia. There were military coups to establish neoliberal order. People died in every country in thousands. They were exiled. They were tortured. So it wasn't subtle at all. After 1990s, it might look like subtle, because in 1980s, that violence already rooted out, weeded out the progressive generation or even two generations. So it wasn't subtle. In Italy, in Spain, in France, there was massive resistance against the policies, the New World Order, so to speak. In Europe, in Britain as well. I mean, like Margaret Thatcher, was she subtle? I don't think so. I mean, like mine workers or, you know, all these worker unions wouldn't say that she was subtle at all. And she was called a milk snatcher. So the subtlety, it can look a little bit more subtle. People were not really dying or tortured in thousands in Europe and in the United States, but in Latin America, in Middle East, in Asia, they were really oppressed through incredible violence. So how do we go out of this? That is the, you know, $1 million question. Obviously, there is no magic answer. It is the good old word of getting organized. This is the only way out, getting organized.
We actually first met at a launch event for your book under the new title of The Seven Steps from Democracy to Fascism. I think you made a point in your Q&A around how a lot of sort of fascist authoritarian leaders are really close allies with each other. I mean, you look at Trump, you look at Orban, all these guys are friends and they work together. And you don't necessarily see that as much on the left. It was something that I wanted to ask you at the time. Do you see sparks of similar kind of allyship, but from the progressives?
This is a point that I made when I first published the book in 2019, and I'm still making the same point. The call of this book is like, let's get together globally, because the only way today to beat fascism globally is a global solidarity. Fascism cannot be beaten in one country. And Western countries are still making the same mistake, thinking that their establishment, their central politics will be formidable enough to, you know, send away this passing fancy, as they think. It will not be. And fascism can only be beaten through global solidarity. My idea when writing the book, and it is still the same, is to tell to the world that, okay, there is only one magic formula, if there is one magic formula. It is to bring the experience that is accumulated already in the global south with the stamina, political stamina of the Western countries. Because in Turkey and in several other countries such as Italy, you know, India, Hungary, Poland, we are exhausted. We have experience. We know how it happens and how it progresses, this process of, you know, authoritarianship or like fascism. We know the signs of it and we know what not to do, at least. But we are exhausted because individually and also as a society, it is exhausting to go through this insanity. Because fascism, as we talked about it before, it doesn't come in like, you know, okay, here I am called fascism, nice to meet you. It comes through, you know, incredibly elusive, extremely tricky ways. And in the Western countries, they're still in the phase of being puzzled, you know, and asking themselves what to do. There is this massive confusion still, but then their energy is intact. Political and moral energy is intact. Because in other countries, after enough time of political insanity, the corruption doesn't stay in the political realm, but it also embraces the moral realm. So the moral pillars of a society, the moral pillars of individual are shaken as well. The Western countries are still not there. So I think we have to take this opportunity, use this little opening of time and use it to bring together the experience of Global South and the stamina of the Western societies to fight against this phenomena that is haunting all of us.
So I think when we look at the global solidarity that has emerged around Gaza and solidarity with Palestine, I mean, week after week for more than a year now, people around the world have been marching and protesting. And on the one hand, it's incredibly inspiring. And, you know, people who may have never been involved in any sort of protest activism movement like this are now getting involved. And we held a really great event a couple of weeks ago with different leaders of various grassroots movements about how we can continue building on this solidarity and how we can keep putting pressure on. But I think at the same time, you know, people are getting exhausted and frustrated. And as much as these marches happen on a weekly basis, like they're not turning into the results that people are demanding. So when you say earlier that, you know, this movement building is hard, it's not going to be easy, what do you say to people around what's happened so far and, you know, how do we keep up this stamina?
After I Have to Lose a Country, I wrote a book called Together, a Manifesto Against the Heartless World. This is why I wrote the book. When it was published in 2020, or 21, I thought, I think this is too early for them, for Western audiences, because they are not there yet. They don't know how it feels like losing everything and being absolutely exhausted and hitting a wall constantly. I think it is time for Together now, because this is a time when people started questioning what hope is. This is the time when people start losing hope. I know how it feels. I mean, like, we've been there, a certain. You do things and you keep on doing them. You resist and say no and then shout and, you know, come together, do it again. And then at some point you question your own actions and your own existence, even saying that, does it worth it? Am I doing it for nothing? So that is the place where you actually lose faith, not only in politics, but in humanity, in humans, in yourself even. That is the hardest part of this struggle. But I think that is why we have to think about the word faith. Faith is such a magical word because it makes you do things even there is no hope. It gives you the stamina to keep on going when there is no, you know, visible reason to do it anymore. It is the raison d'etre of being human and staying humane. So if you have faith, I mean, like, faith is a word that sounds religious, obviously, and it is monopolized by religion for such a long time that we forgot, actually, we humans were the ones who invented faith. So we have the capacity to believe. And to all those exhausted people, I should say, keep your faith because we have nothing else.
We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Amy Hall, and I'm one of the co-editors at New Internationalist magazine. I wanted to take a minute to thank our amazing global network of journalists who cover the stories that the mainstream media ignores from every continent. It's down to them that New Internationalist has been able to platform these alternative perspectives for more than 50 years and give a human face to the news. To get more of our reporting and analysis directly to your door or inbox, please consider subscribing to New Internationalist via the link in our show notes. Subscribe.newint.org.
The September-October issue of New Internationalist magazine was all about the crisis of establishment politics. And Conrad, my co-editor who edited that magazine, in his piece, as well as the pieces he commissioned, looked at the forces that are reshaping party politics in places like the Philippines, the UK, Bolivia. And when, you know, this is the biggest election year in history, and in at least the case of the UK, you know, a number of independent candidates have been successful. Recently in the Kashmir elections, there were a number of independent candidates running. Conrad sort of argues in his piece, though, that these individual independents aren't enough on their own to enact the change that we want to see, that really it has to ultimately come down to movement building and you know, global solidarity in this way. Can you maybe talk about that a bit in the sense of what, in your view, will it take to build a politics that actually serves the cause of the people?
This is a hard question. Independence, you know, being in democratic institutions, in the establishment, is something we have to support. I think we have to accept that this is going to be a wide spectrum of political struggle. There'll be people in defense. There'll be our guys in the establishment. There'll be NGOs. There'll be, you know, small movements of working class and so on. And there will be times of crisis, that all these movements come together to push for the change. Now I'm looking at from Occupy, from Seattle to Tahrir, and what I see is they set a new bar, all these moments. They didn't perhaps change something in particular in the system, but they set a bar of what we can do, what people can do if they act together. These moments gave us a space to imagine. I think we are still trying to find out what we can do with that space. We have to come to terms with the fact that we have to have love in politics. Speaking about love, I don't mean butterflies. I'm talking about political love. We have to learn to be more accepting, more forgiving, and more trustful to each other. We don't trust each other. I think we exhaust each other a lot among progressives, among leftists, and so on. We should stop exhausting each other. We're going to be exhausted by, you know, fascism really well very soon. So we have to stop exhausting each other. We have to trust each other more. All these things are emotional things. But then the reason I'm talking about these emotions is because we are living in the time of politics of emotions. Politics of emotions is used masterfully by fascism. They're using the emotion of fear, hate, but in order to counter this movement, in order to do the, you know, the exact opposite, we have to go back to politics of emotions as well. Among the progressive zeitgeist, the dominant view has been a discriminating, dividing view. We constantly talk about what differentiates us from the others among the progressives. Remember what we're talking about. You know, we're talking about identity politics. It's not that I am against identity politics. It's just that, you know, how this shapes our discourse, how this shapes our perception of ourselves is becoming really damaging. And it's making us forget that what we actually imagine for the world requires love and acceptance and humility, most of all. What happened during the pandemic, especially, was a good tutorial about how to do things. First of all, what pandemic showed us was the Hollywood dystopian, you know, imagination of future of humanity is absolutely bullshit. Because when crises happen, people tend to help each other and be in solidarity, and they become even more, even loving, you know, towards each other. So we have to imagine politics as a, you know, natural disaster or like a disaster like pandemic. And we have to act like that.
Yeah. And I guess that's the kind of double-edged sword of social media is, on the one hand, you know, we can find our communities online and we can really build this solidarity online. But on the flip side, it can be, as we know, the breeding ground for everything awful that we're seeing happen all around the world. And it was something actually that we talked about. Nanjala Niyabola, who is the guest editor for our current issue, which is about disinformation.
When I see people in the US, in Europe, take their democracy for granted by enabling fascism and enabling extremism in the name of, you know, these guys are making me money, so I'm going to look the other way, you're playing with fire.
I think that just kind of goes back to what your point too, around how a lot of us in the West don't know what it's like. And, you know, we can be on our high horses and talk about how we counter it and like all of the wonderful things we're doing to protect democracy, but it's because we haven't actually lost it, but we're very, very close to losing it, as you've kind of laid out. So I guess kind of as a final question then, you know, for the many societies, Western societies in particular around the world that are on this sort of cliff edge of a descent into fascism, what needs to change? And is there anything that we can do as regular people so that we don't fall over the cliff edge?
One thing should be very clear to people. This happened on the scale of cities in the last two decades. And now it's happening on an international scale. And what's happening is the system is getting rid of the poor because they don't need the poor anymore as much as they did in the 1980s or 1990s. We are going through something in the scale of industrial revolution. And, you know, the world order is changing. A new Middle East is being drawn, new borders are drawn almost. So all this insanity that we're going through on one level is very much connected to that. So in this new world, people should know they do not count. This may seem like a too dark picture of things, But then it gives us humility as well. And also it liberates us. They don't need us, so they can get rid of us any minute. So we are actually free to do whatever we want. So we are nobodies now. They do not need us, and they do not ask our consent. So I think we are free to do politics for the first time and in decades. We have to look at this as a liberation point and then act with that kind of freedom and humility. Because being nobody is being everybody, actually. So we have to enjoy ourselves being nobodies.
That was Etche Temelkuran. Her new book, Nation of Strangers, will be published by Canongate next year. New Internationalist is an independent media cooperative based in the UK. We're proud to be co-owned by our readers and staff. We've been publishing award-winning, in-depth analysis on global progressive issues since 1973, and we're really excited to present this new podcast series to you. If you liked the show and you want us to make more episodes like this, please leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts. It really helps other people to find us. And if you don't already, please consider becoming a subscriber. You'll gain access to our latest issue on disinformation, as well as our full 50-year archive. Listeners to the show can get 20% off their first year of a print or digital subscription using the promo code THEWORLDUNSPUN at checkout. That's it from us. This episode was hosted and produced by me, Maxine Betteridge-Mose. I'm the digital editor at New Internationalist. Co-editors of the magazine are Amy Hall, Bethany Riley, Conrad Landon, and Nick Dowson. Our editorial assistant is Paula Lacey. Our theme music has been produced by Samuel Raphael Williams, and our logo design is by Mari Fuz. Audio editing is by Nasik Hamza. Special thank you to the folks at Impress, the UK's independent media regulator, for helping us get this podcast off the ground. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.